Okay, good afternoon. I've just returned from my visit to Indonesia and Singapore, a visit that has reinforced the importance of Asia to the future of New Zealand. As you know, increasing our trade and investment with the rest of the world is an important part of the government's plan to build a more productive economy. We need to earn our way in the world. Indonesia is potentially a huge market and important business partner for New Zealand. It's the fourth most populated country in the world, and it's our nearest Asian neighbour. Indonesia has just this year ratified the ASEAN Australia New Zealand FTA, and as a country we need to make the most of this agreement, just as we're doing with other Asian countries including China. I took a delegation of business leaders with me who found the trip to be very worthwhile. During the visit, Auckland Airport signed an MOU with the airline Garuda, which is an important step towards a direct service between Indonesia and New Zealand. And Fonterra announced it will be opening its first processing plant in Indonesia. At a government-to-government level, we signed off on a program of cooperation, geothermal energy, of which Indonesia has huge untapped reserves. The government will also be appointing a trade commissioner to Jakarta. This is a new position and will add impetus to the job of building business links between Indonesia and New Zealand. My ministers have also been busy during the recess, pushing New Zealand's inks case in many countries. Deputy Prime Minister Bill English led New Zealand's ministerial delegation to the Australian-New Zealand Leadership Forum in Sydney a couple of weeks ago. Stephen Joyce, Murray McCulley, Tim Grosser and Craig Foss were all there. You'll know that the next year is the 30th anniversary of CER, a world-leading free trade agreement, and we're keen to take our already close relationship with Australia in this respect to even further heights. The feedback from the forum was particularly positive. Australian business leaders admire New Zealand's encouraging economic policy settings, and some are already moving jobs to New Zealand, recognising our competitive advantages around general economic policy direction, the exchange rate, regulations and tax. There has to be positive for jobs and incomes on the side of the Tasman. Stephen Joyce also travelled to Oman, Qatar and Saudi Arabia to raise New Zealand's profile as a destination for international students and to support education companies seeking to grow their businesses in the region. Tim Grosser, meanwhile, led a trade mission of 14 companies to Chongqing in inland China and subsequently attended the G20 trade ministers meeting in Mexico. This is a rare honour and recognises Tim's very strong reputation on the international stage. So all this demonstrates this government's commitment to building on our strong trade and investment ties around the world so we can deliver more jobs and higher incomes to New Zealanders. In terms of ministerial activity, tomorrow I'll be in New Plymouth. On Wednesday I'll attend the Anzac Dawn service in Auckland, then I'll attend the national service here at the War Memorial in Wellington. On Thursday I'm in the southern part of the Northland electorate, and on Friday I'll visit in Christchurch. On Saturday and Sunday I'll be attending the National Party mainland conference in Dunedin. Questions?
Did you get the support of John Banks and Peter Dunn for any legislative challenge that you need through this deal to consent?
Well, I didn't have any direct discussions with them about it, but they will obviously want to look at the deal, but my expectation is yes, I'll support it.
Why have you spoken to them about it in principle?
Oh, well, look, I don't remember having conversations with them. I think at the end of the day, we'll be wanting to present the deal to them, but you know, my sense is if we can conclude a deal, then they will see the same benefits that many New Zealanders will see, which is more jobs, better opportunities for our young people, a good environment to be operating in, and 200,000 extra visitor nights coming from overseas. And I think all of those things make that deal pretty compelling. As we know, deals unlikely to require taxpayer funds or us running the convention centre. Again, I think they're all positives.
Do you don't expect any problems from that?
Well, I haven't had, from memory, I can't remember having any detailed discussions with them, but no, I wouldn't expect problems. I mean, providing we can get a deal concluded with Sky City, which is logical. I mean, that's been the process of negotiation now with officials and the Minister of MED's office for some time. Obviously, we're working hard to make sure it's a good deal for taxpayers, can't just be a good deal for Sky City. But if that's the case, then hopefully we'll get there. I think it's getting closer, last time I asked.
What do you mean by getting closer? Weeks or?
Don't know exactly. I mean, as the Minister said yesterday, he's always reluctant to put a date on these things because it weakens the government's negotiating hand.
You say unlikely to require taxpayer funds. I thought it couldn't require taxpayer funds for the government to go ahead with it.
Well, there's always a range of options, but our preferred option is we don't have to put taxpayer funds in.
You still will go ahead with it if there is a requirement for taxpayer funds?
Well, let's wait and see. My preferred option is we don't have to put taxpayer funds in.
Isn't it odd that you haven't done a study at all on any social impact or harm from increasing the number of paper machines in Sky City. To lay that up against the economic benefits that you say would come from any deal.
We've done a feasibility study on the overall economic benefits of a convention centre, and what that showed was that there are real benefits for the region and for the country, but they're not all captured in one place, which is the convention centre, and that's the reason why these things never generally wash their face, and that's what we've seen around the world. In terms of poking machines and the impact of that, well, the good news part of this story is there'll be less poking machines in New Zealand, not more, so the economic or social impact is less impact, not more impact.
But there's going to be fewer poking machines anyway, because I mean that's
a great story,
anyway,
isn't it?
But you're going to put in more into the Auckland casino. I mean, so there'd be even fewer if it weren't for this deal.
Maybe or maybe not. But all I can tell you is there'll be less in the rest of that.
How many jobs do you estimate all up that the convention centre would create?
About 800 full time and part time, and about 900 constructed.
So there was the Herald actually did an interesting comparison over the weekend to other convention centres that showed actually a lot fewer full-time staff for greater capacity. So where do your numbers come from?
Yeah, ours are advice from MED, but you've got to remember the Herald used full-time equivalents. They didn't use casual staff. If you have the combination of full-time and casual, comes up to 800. They use a multiplier effect of some order. Again, if you look at Melbourne has about 500 casual staff, as I understand, working in the convention centre.
So you're talking about the jobs that relate directly to the operation of the convention centre,
about
800. And 900 in construction and then build up.
That's the last idea.
The Melbourne convention centre is half owned by a New Zealand investment fund, which you didn't consider as good a bet as Sky City. Can you explain why? I mean, did you ever get any numbers?
Well, I think when you say you're using that in the broader sense. For a start off, the decision about whether it was decided as a good deal or not was made by MED officials. They looked at all five of the particular proposals. They used a series of assessments to make a judgment call, but in the application put in by Infratool, there was no recommendation that they would be putting in any funding. So it would have required 100% government funding.
Did you ever talk to Lloyd Morrison about
not from memory, no.
So can you see why that might give the impression that Sky City had the inside running, given that you had discussions with him, but you know, despite Lloyd Morrison, who's a pretty well noted businessman personally writing to you?
Well, firstly, if in theory we had gone down that route, you'd be making the same claims, wouldn't you? You'd say, because I knew Lloyd Morrison and because he contacted me directly, somehow they got the deal. Secondly, we went through the process of saying that we wanted a convention centre with quite a number of parties. We also said, why don't you put up your best option, but the government's preferred option is not to put in cash. There was only one bid that came in that position, and it was Sky City. And for that reason, it was a much more superior bid to any of the others.
Can you say that categorically, if those other bidders didn't produce numbers? Because I think this morning you've said that you've just made it clear Sky City were the only ones that came up.
They were the only ones, yeah.
With numbers. Correct. But you never saw any numbers from any of the other bids.
What I saw was I didn't look at all of the bids. I got a recommendation. MED handled that process. Went through a full and thorough process across a number of criteria. MED came back with a recommendation and said, look, if you want to build a convention centre, firstly, we think this is a superior bid on a number of different categories, location, ability to run it, likely to be successful, etc., etc., but also doesn't require government funding.
So very clearly, the MED advice to you was go with Sky City.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
The long-term jobs that create set from what you're saying will be casual and most likely low-paid, won't they?
I wouldn't accept that. Firstly, I mean, there'll be about 900 jobs of people who construct it, and they're not low paid, as we know there's a big range there. And as say, about 800 full-time or casual, there'll be a variety of different things. But, I mean, if you take a step back from that is the convention centre, and I think you've got to understand why the government's in this position. That is because it wants a national convention centre that, as I said to you, it captures some of the economic benefit at that convention centre, but not all of it. So I don't know whether you class a 747 or a 777 captain as low paid or unskilled. I don't. But they'll be flying the people in from overseas, landing at Auckland Airport. I don't know if you consider a top chef at a major restaurant to be low paid or unskilled. but I don't. And many of those people will be eating there. In the end, the government wants this for a very clear reason. Economic growth and jobs. And this will create 200,000 visitor nights who spend roughly double what the average tourist does at the moment. Now, this is an industry that right back from to 2003 has been arguing the National Convention Centre is an important piece of infrastructure to grow the tourism sector. As I've said so often last week, there is nothing magical about this, and despite your best efforts, no conspiracy. It's just a simple fact of life that the government wants to see a National Convention Centre, and this might come as a shock to you, but Bill English doesn't have $350 million to give me to build one.
But do you agree that a convention centre would be a lot further down the track if you weren't having to go through, close to a year's worth of negotiation? I mean, if you had just signed someone on rather than doing all these long negotiations, it would have been a lot further along the track, right?
Well, it's important that there's a good deal for the taxpayer, so a thorough process is important. That's what we're going through at the moment. Secondly, let's go back to 2003. Do you know what the surplus was that year? You know what it was in 2004 and 2005 and 2006 and 2007? The answer is a lot of money. And in none of those circumstances, despite all of the feasibility study and all of the economic benefits, they were never built. And the simple facts of life are these things don't make money in isolation. They make money for the overall economy. So yeah, are we being creative looking for a deal? Yes. Is it in Auckland and New Zealand's best interest? Yes. Will there be less poker machines at the end of this transaction over time? Yes.
Why did you stop the business case going ahead?
Well, that's pretty simple. What happened was in 2008, when we got the advice as the incoming minister, we said, yeah, we'll put in some money to a feasibility study. There were a number of partners that put in that money. We put in $50,000 at the end of that. The officials came back and said, as a result of the feasibility study, you should go ahead and build a convention centre. We think it's a good idea. We'll now do your mock business case, if you like. I said, forget about the mock business case. Let's go out and see if anyone's prepared to put up their money.
So there was no connection with Sky City indicating that they were prepared to...
Not despite your wildest conspiracies, John, no.
Who else put in money for the feasibility
study? I can't remember, but like, my office can give you. I think it was Auckland Council and somebody else. The three partners in the community.
Did all the other potential bidders know that there were law changes on the table that may benefit their business, or was it only...
Well, to a number of people, we said, look, the government doesn't have a lot of money, so we'd have to be creative. But there are always options. You could put on a big tax, you could put on a departure tax. All of those things have been considered and looked at. My business is probably the best one.
Well, Minister, will the government consider granting asylum for any of the Afghani translators?
Well, I think what we'd say is, you know, obviously we'll look very closely at that situation, as I think all countries would need to. We wouldn't want to leave people who have been integral in the process high and dry or at risk of their lives. But equally, we need to have discussions with both our partners and the individuals to assess the merits of their case. I haven't had any advice on that, but I know that the minister is going to go and look at that situation.
What do you think of this idea from a health ministry discussion paper? If you really want to make New Zealand smoke free by 2020,
yeah,
make cigarette packets $100 a pack.
It sounds like an awful lot. I mean, the government unashamedly has been wanting to increase the price of cigarettes and take a number of other steps to deter people from smoking, including potentially plain packaging and looking at displays, cabinets. And they're all part of an integrated approach to deter people from wanting to smoke. Whether it get to $100 a packet and whether that would be sustainable in terms of the black market, I don't know. It sounds like a big step for me.
What do you make of the US Chamber of Commerce statement that was put out over the weekend raising concerns about New Zealand's move towards introducing plain packaging?
Well, I haven't seen the statement, but I've had some oral conversations with the Minister of Trade. And from memory, the things he said to me is that there's nothing in the trade agreements that we currently have that would preclude us from having plain packaging. Certainly in terms of the United States, which is where there's a case currently between Australia, as I'm sure you're aware, we don't have an FTA with the United States. So I haven't had any advice that would support the view that we can't undertake plain packaging.
They seem to believe that it undermines intellectual property rights and could affect future trade deals.
Well, I'm sure they're representing the views of their cigarette manufacturers, but whether that's actually correct or not is a very different issue.
So when the
casinos up and running in the convention centre, how many full-time equivalent jobs will there be?
I think it's about 200 or 300 full-time equivalents and about 500 casual, about 800 jobs as we've seen.
You said 800 in full-time and part-time.
Yeah, so that's a total 800, yeah.
Just going back to, are you confident that you'll get the support from your partners in terms of any legislative change that are required resulting in this deal?
Well, we need to take them through it, but yeah.
So you don't remember having a conversation yourself with Mr.
I don't know. I mean, I may have had a conversation with them, but I don't recall it. It may have come up in our confidence in supply just generally when we were negotiating, because it's been well and truly in the public domain for a long time. It's possible, but I just honestly don't remember it.
Why are you so confident that you have your support? If you can't have discussions, and we have had discussions, yeah. And they haven't indicated to you, is that, and you just take it for granted that it's a lapdog?
No, I think because they'll see it as a good deal. I mean, that's what I think most New Zealanders will think. I mean, as I said to your question the other day, I mean, if you could put up a proposal to New Zealanders that will increase the number of tourists by 200,000 a year, create more jobs, have an important piece of infrastructure that's important for the tourism sector, and over time, see less pokey machines in New Zealand, I think we'd have universal support.
Well, Minister, on the Mahid Bouvili and the Algerian custody case, that contemporary minister, Ms. Kelly, said that he promised to review.
Yep.
And I'm just wondering if you can tell us where that's at.
I can, if you just give me 1 second, I can tell exactly the words. But she is. Just looking, 1 second. Look, the long and short of it is, that she is working, as I understand it, with the Algerian authorities at the moment around her status and therefore her capacity to be able to argue a custody case.
She's claiming, and her family are claiming that since the initial intervention back in Feb with Edgar Fisher Barbara Robin,
yep.
There's been no assistance from the government. Do you think that's a lot?
No, I don't think that's true. I mean, MFAT officials have been actively engaged for quite some time, and they've been documented in the papers. I mean, this is, as we've always said, quite a complex situation. Where basically you've got two parents tied up in a custody dispute, but obviously one of them is an Algerian citizen, and now we're trying to apply Algerian law, which is complex as a starting point. So, New Zealand officials have been doing everything they can, as best we can, when we're in the middle of a custody dispute.
What do you think about John Anderson's comments on the Greater New Zealand about Australian troops being bludgers and thieves?
I find them offensive. I mean, you know, we're about to go and commemorate in 2 days' time the Anzac tradition, and while I have enormous respect for New Zealand forces and support the views at one point that he put forward, which is our forces are have and continue to be magnificent in the work that they carry out, denigrating the Australians as part of that analysis, I don't think it's appropriate.
Do you have a message, Prime Minister, for those Australian soldiers?
Well, I just regret that those comments, because, you know, I've seen the Australian forces on a number of situations when I've been in places like Afghanistan, when I've seen them in Gallipoli and various other places, and, you know, the spirit of the Anzac tradition is alive and well. That was a tradition forged on the battlegrounds in Gallipoli, and to take away from their efforts, I personally find quite offensive.
You talked about how, you know, you and other ministers have been overseas and trying to open doors. Trade, and obviously talk about the convention centre about bringing in more tourists. Last week, Russell Norman got figures and stats about, you know, Statistics New Zealand study looking at still the main issue for exporters and the tourism industry is the level of the New Zealand dollar.
Yeah.
I mean, but I'm just wondering, is there anything that you can see still that could be done around the dollar that would help exporters and the tourism industry?
Well, firstly, I mean, what the government is doing is trying to take pressure off all manufacturers and exporters through better regulation and better policy, and that certainly helps. So I've always believed we should apply our minds to the things that we can definitely control, and that is business regulation, business tax, all of those issues. Secondly, the big issue, or one of the big issues, I think, is that in terms of supporting monetary policy, if we run tight fiscal policy, then we take the pressure off the Reserve Bank, and we're going to have a pretty much a zero budget on May 24th, And that's another example of where we're supporting monetary policy by taking the pressure off that. So I think that's all really important. Third thing I'd just sort of say is that, you know, there is, that while I accept, you know, for non-commodity linked exporters, the exchange rate is causing them problems, and we've said for quite some time now, we think that the US-New Zealand exchange rate is overvalued. I think it's important to put a bit of perspective around it. The high exchange rate takes pressure off oil prices, and that's quite a big component part. The high exchange rate takes pressure off imported inflation, and that takes pressure off the Reserve Bank. That's important. Many manufactured goods which are exported have an imported component. And again, a higher exchange rate helps that. So it's not all bad news, but it certainly puts pressure on someone.
So when you said in Indonesia that the government's considering ways to mitigate the risks,
I think you've got to read the whole quote. And the whole quote makes it pretty clear that I don't believe an intervention, never have, and frankly never will. I've spent my professional life looking at it and it fails.
But you're meaning the existing government policy.
I'm talking about all the things I just talked about then. You know, if we go out there and make sure the RMA works properly, employment legislation works properly, tax law is functioning properly, all those things are things within our control. Dreaming that we can somehow get the exchange rate down through intervention is la-la land stuff.
On the paper farms, do you have any concerns that Tangaraki would register those two brand names, in particular the Pure 100 brand name?
Look, I hadn't seen that they had registered. They'll obviously have to make sure they comply with the law. I mean, there have been previous attempts by other people to use 100% pure, and my knowledge of that is that they've been fought and resisted by tourism. So if they were in any way in breach of that, then I'm sure Tourism New Zealand would look at that.
Well, Tourism New Zealand told me that they registered the 100% pure brand name for tourism-related businesses, but it was open to other organisations to register other brands. But Pure 100 is pretty clearly designed to leverage off of New Zealand's international reputation, is it not? And I mean, is that something that you're comfortable a Chinese-controlled company using New Zealand's tourism marketing money and the effect of that to actually leverage their commercial business?
Well, if tourism haven't tried to close that angle down, it's because they believe that they've properly satisfied any concerns they might have with people that would use it in relation to the tourism sector. There's probably lots of people who use 100% pure in different forms in other industries. I don't know, I haven't looked at it, but I'm sure that's the case. All I can tell you is that they're very protective when it gets to anywhere near the tourism sector and marketing campaigns.
But I mean, in this case, it's a company, Russell Law has raised the issue of what happens if there's a scandal, a melamine-type scandal involving milk products in China, and that product has got a brand name, Pure 100, which associates with New Zealand. Aren't we risking our international branding?
No, because, I mean, look, there was always that risk, actually, that there was a much bigger issue when Fonterra was the part owner of San Lu, and there was a melamine scandal. Actually, what the international markets did was pretty quickly differentiate between a New Zealand sourced product and a Chinese sourced product. And certainly in the case of New Zealand, which is the company you're effectively talking about, as you know, there's 27 conditions sitting around the Crayford Farms bid. And one of those includes that they can't be vertically integrated. So the probability of things like a melamine scandal is certainly much, much lower in the New Zealand environment.
If you raise the issue of vertical integration, vertically integrated. But everyone says that Chinese interest is more in food security than it is in land ownership. How do those two things sit side by side? How do the Chinese secure food security if they can't control processing of these others?
Well, you have to go and ask them that.
What's your reading on it?
Well, my view is that the motivations of China wanting to tap into New Zealand's food supply are pretty clear. You know, they're becoming much wealthier. New Zealand product is world class. And the logic behind them wanting to be able to tap into that resource is apparent for anyone. I think they are going to prove to be, you know, probably our most crucial market when it comes to food supply, just the sheer development of that economy.
Do you think that, just to shift the focus a little bit, do you think that the rules around the OIO, the rules that the OIO considers, particularly in terms of that with and without scenario that they look at, do you think they need addressing? Because reading through the report they issued last week, they were taking into account things like Shanghai Pension's promises on the environment, over Māori, Waitapu, that kind of stuff. Well, you can hardly do a with and without analysis of those because there's no New Zealand bidder who's promising to do that, and no requirement on them to do it.
Yeah, so I'm not a lawyer, and just catch my comments in that regard, but I think if you go and look at Justice Miller's ruling, what he actually says when he says to you look at the with and without, is he also is quite clear that it's not a requirement, one assumes, he says the ministers, but one assumes that also means the OIO, to actually model that counterfactual bid. He says you just have to consider what that counterfactual bid might be. It's not specific. That's my understanding of it anyway. In terms of the overall legislation, look, there's always a degree of judgment in there. The OIO and ministers are required to make an assessment across a lot of different categories, and I think they've done their best to assess that given the information that they have. It's not perfect, but it's as good as it can be.
So did that lack of specificity in that High Court ruling really allow the pension application to proceed? Because you could say, in good faith, yes, we have considered that, then on we go. So
no, I'm just saying,
too much difference?
What is a little bit different is that the before and after test is reasonably easy to quantify. The with or without test asks you to consider a notional counterfactual bid which actually isn't there, and how you construct that bid. The judge in his ruling sees it's actually not the necessary ingredient to actually go and spell all of that out. Now, quite how you assess that is for others to look at, not me.
I mean, you was comment around this bit about whether there would have been as much public interest if it hadn't been a Chinese bid, because obviously we've had German and Swiss interest by dairy farms and thousands, etc. But if there's a strategic sense that China's really looking to get into the dairy industry here, I mean, would that create a bit of a worry if there was a real Chinese demand to buy a whole lot more farms?
Well, look, I think my own view is that we'd welcome Chinese investment in New Zealand, just like we, you know, welcome investment from a number of countries. But personally, I'd rather channel that investment into processing and moving up the value chain. I think a straight transfer of selling huge tracts of New Zealand land isn't overly in our interest. My main point has been, I don't think that's actually happening at this point. I mean, if you go back to about, I think it's 2005 or 2006, there's been over 800,000 hectares of land sold. And prior to the Crayford Farms sale to Shanghai Pingjin, there'd been 223 hectares sold. So I think, you know, that's, it's more a perception than a reality. Now, if that perception turned into reality, government might want to go back and address that position, but that's not what we're currently facing.
Do you think people might be more concerned about China than opposed to, say, Germany or Switzerland and those types of purchases? Because China is, as you say, has a massive population, is developing, and may well be a country that, you know, needs food security as opposed to the other ones. So, you know, people are a bit worried about their motivations in comparison to those other countries.
Well, I think what is true, if you look at China as their capacity to buy substantial amounts of land or to invest anyway, is unquestioned. I mean, they have nearly $4 trillion in reserves, and they clearly have a strong motivation in terms of 1.5 billion people in their country. So they've got a lot of interest. But I don't think that is going to convert to massive sales of land to Chinese buyers. And all the government said the whole way through this process is we just need to be consistent. If we think that there's too much land being sold to foreigners, irrelevant of their ethnicity, then the government may look to tighten up the rules. At this point, because we've been selling at a much slower rate than Labor was, I think you've got to argue we're probably in reasonable shape. If that dynamic changes, then the government reserves right to do it.
The Chinese entity itself said there are a lot of Chinese investors looking at this application, and basically if it gets the go ahead, it's going to pique the interest of a whole, you know, a lot of other investors. So, pressure may well increase, demand may well increase, and is that the scenario you're talking about, that if it gets to that stage, when you see themselves, it'll, you know, probably spur quite a lot of interest in New Zealand land?
Well, I think let's see. I think what the Chinese would have been looking for is consistency. And if the answer was no, in the Crayford Farms deal, I think they'd be totally comfortable with that, as long as the answer would be no for any foreign buyer. Whether the fact that some people might be looking at that deal means they're necessarily going to go and buy land is a very different issue. But maybe they were just looking at the way we might assess foreign investment. For instance, when Labor turned down the Canadian pension plan deal to buy into Auckland airports, there was a lot of commentary in the business media that really deterred investment in New Zealand, because there was a very unclear picture of whether foreign investment was welcome, didn't he? It was all going to go into airports. So I don't think you can necessarily join the dots if all means it's going to go into land.
The MED paper that was released last week talks of countries other than China, investors who'd be looking askance at the delays or whatever else, and have been holding back on investments. It doesn't actually list those, but are you aware of any companies from overseas that have been holding back on investments?
Is that the impact letter from Murray McCulley to Morris Williams?
Yeah, there's a paper attached to it.
Yeah, okay, sure. Look, I haven't had extensive conversations with them about that. I'm sure there were lots of people around the world looking at this. I mean, I think within New Zealand there'll be a lot of people looking to see how the OIO and government handles this. I mean, ultimately, when you get a landmark ruling as we got from Justice Miller, then lots of people will take, you know, past interest in that, see what it might mean.
Isn't there the 10% discount for elderly and unwanted power prices in the state's budget? You got any chance of getting that?
In a word, no. I mean, look, if you go and have a look at what we've done, I can tell you exactly. We have, in time that we've been in office, essentially from 1 April 2008, so slightly before we came in, to now, if you count the increase that's going to go through on 1 April 2012, increased the pension by $194 per couple per fortnight. That's an increase of 22%. So I'd be the first to acknowledge there'll be some pensioners that find it difficult to pay the power bill, but I think the government's been doing a good job of trying to get New Zealand Super up. Secondly, Winston Peters was part of a government that saw energy prices rise by 72% over the period that Labor were in office, some period of which they were with Winston Peters, and the entire time Winston Peters was with that Labor government, I don't recall him ever giving pensioners a 10% reduction in their power bills. So maybe he owes an apology for what he did in terms of supporting Labor back from 2005 to 2008, and I look forward to hearing the apology. Afterwards.